ॐ द्यौः शान्तिरन्तरिक्षं शान्ति पृथिवी शान्ति ओषधयः शान्ति वनस्पतयः शान्तिः विश्वे देवा शान्तिर्ब्रह्म शान्ति सर्वं शान्ति शान्तिरेव शान्तिः सा मा शान्तिरेधि ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. सो टुडेस् सब्जेक्ट् एस् यु नो इस् धम्मपद बुद्धस् मेसेज् टु द वर्ल्ड्. Now, Dhammapada is the most popular and in a way the most condensed summary of Buddha's teachings. Just as we have Bible for Christianity, the Bhagavad Gita for Hinduism, we have a huge philosophical and spiritual literature in Buddhist tradition. But of all these canonical works, Dhammapada is considered to be the most representative canonical work of Buddhism, especially the Theravada school of Buddhism, the more ascetic, the more conservative and orthodox school of Buddhism. When you talk about the canonical background of Buddhism, you have to remember, there are two stages in the evolution of Buddhist canon. One, the first stage representing the main books, which are three in number, which are written in Pali language, which is maybe an unrefined form of Sanskrit, the script in which the early teachings of Buddha as recorded and recollected in the first Buddhist council were put together in three important canonical works. So they are called baskets, pitakas. It's called Tripitaka. Three canonical works. Prakrit was the language in which Buddha spoke. Buddha spoke in the language of the masses, not in Sanskrit. And all these writings were later recollected by the great Buddhist bhikshus who assembled in Rajagriha, not far from today's Patna, the capital city of one of India's provinces called Bihar. So that was the location where the first Buddhist council, maybe in a way, historically speaking, the first religious council was held in Rajagriha, almost 50 years after Buddha's passing away. So there were still many of his early monastic disciples of Buddha alive, and they recollected, and these were all put together in this Pali canonical. It is called Tripitaka, Sutta Pitaka, Vinaya Pitaka, and Abhidhamma Pitaka, which together deal with the philosophical, the ontological, the metaphysical, and also the monastic structure, the disciplines to be followed by the Buddhist monastics. You have to remember, the Buddhism is becoming popular in a totally non-monastic cultural landscape like America today. But Buddhism originally had an exclusively monastic setting. That is something very interesting and maybe a matter of interest for many critical scholars, you know. Buddhism is becoming popular because it is simple, straightforward, psychological, and doesn't speak about a monotheistic creator God, doesn't ask you to believe blindly in certain dogmas and doctrines which you are not allowed to question, which you are not expected to challenge under the peril of excommunication till a few centuries ago. So Buddhism in that respect is very open and very non-conformist and non-orthodox and deeply humanistic. So I'm going to discuss a few important teachings from Dhammapada. I will quote or may recite the Pali verses, and then I will explain the translation, and also I will try to give in a nutshell the story background, because Dhammapada has got various dimensions, you know. It deals with the ideal of a holy person, the Brahmana Varga, which comes in the 26th section of the Dhammapada. But it begins with some purely psychological questions. Why do we suffer? And in what way our thought, our mind, and our ideas are linked to what we do? Buddha, surprisingly, draws a line of demarcation between action and mind. He says, it is the mind behind action that is significant and not action in itself. We will go to those subjects later. So come back to the background. So Buddha, there are a few variations, the different views among the historians as to the date of birth or the year on which Buddha was born. The most well-accepted dates, according to many of the traditional historians, is that Buddha was born in 560 BC and passed away in 480 BC. That means he lived for 80 years. He was born in what is now Nepal, which used to be a Hindu nation till very recent times, a predominantly Hindu nation, and well known among the military historians as the birthplace the Gurkhas were considered to be the fiercest warrior races in the world. That's the one unique way Nepal is quoted and referred to by military historians all the way from First World War onwards. Just incidentally I'm mentioning. So coming back to the subject, so as I mentioned, this is a very important book for the Theravada, Stavira-vada, the more orthodox and conservative ascetic order of Buddhism, in contrast to the Mahayana, which is in a way much more broader in its scope. And it comes in one of the subsections called Nikaya, it's called Kuddhaka Nikaya of Suttapidaka. So that is one importance, one special significance of this Suttapidaka, one of the three canonical literary traditions of Buddhism. Now, Dhammapada was originally spoken by Buddha in response to different episodes, questions put to him. So, if you read Dhammapada, you find there are verses, and for each verse, there's a story background. But the significance and implication of the verses go far beyond the story background. If you remove the story, you may lose something very precious in understanding the implications of the verses. If you neglect the verse, then it becomes a kind of work of mythology. So, they say, according to some historians, it was compiled into its present form by a great Buddhist scholar who lived in the 2nd century AD, according to most of the historians, is called Buddha Ghosha. So, if you read it, you find, apparently, these verses were spoken to a particular set of disciples or students, and in that respect, they were limited. But then their philosophical and spiritual significance transcend and go far beyond the limited circumstances or particular circumstances in which they were spoken. Now, you know, very often, you know, Dhammapada is not considered to be a book to be read from cover to cover. Traditional Theravada Buddhists read these verses and meditate and explain and make it a ritual because they want to go deeper into the spiritual significance of the teachings of Buddha. See, for example, just as the ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt, so this doctrine and discipline has but one taste, the taste of freedom. It is from Udana, one of the Pali canonical literature, which in a way signifies the importance of Dhammapada. Dhammapada is a book of spiritual freedom, a book that expounds spiritual freedom in its most sublime sense. That's why the 26th section is called Brahmana Vargo. No, the word Brahmana Vargattam Bruhi Brahmanam Tamaham Brahmanam Bruhi. So, Buddha concludes these verses from the 26th section, which is known as the Brahmana Vagga. Vagga means section, or that particular section of the text. So, each of these verses, he concludes, him I call a Brahmana. I mean, the word Brahmana was used in Buddhist tradition to signify a holy person. That's an important thing to remember. It has absolutely no significance related to a caste or a group or priestly group. In fact, there was no priestcraft in Buddhism. That you should remember. But there was something very close to priestcraft, of course. The Shamanagas and Buddhist bhikshus were welcomed into Buddhist households and revered and respected, and they were given alms, which was considered to be a sacred act. And today, if you go to some countries like Thailand, there are special seats reserved in public transportation, exclusively reserved for Buddhist monks. So there was some kind of respect and honor, which was not an inherited privilege, but given by the late laity, Buddhist laity, to show the respect to the ideal of renunciation practiced by these Buddhist monks. So, again, the central theme of Dhammapada is freedom. He called Vimutti in Pali, which is called Vimukti or liberation. Spiritual freedom in Sanskrit, which means spiritual freedom, liberation of the mind from all bonds and fetters and entanglements. I mean the liberation of our being from suffering. So, which is inseparable in life. So, the ideal of spiritual freedom, the concept of life in this world as a state of bondage from which we must seek freedom, an idea that life continues in cycles. It's called Praditya Samudpada, an important doctrine in Buddhist philosophy as a whole, which I don't have time to elaborate in this particular context. But anyway, so the doctrine of the law of karma, the doctrine of reincarnation, the doctrine or the idea of looking upon life in this world, this life of being born, living, enjoying and suffering at the empirical level, dying, again being reborn, is called Praditya Samudpada. 12 point links together, which is actually rooted in our desire, which actually leads to this bondage. So the desire leads to bondage. And desire is caused by avidya or ignorance, and that leads to bondage. And this problem of suffering is called Chatvari Arya Satyani, or four noble truths in Buddhist tradition. That's again, there is suffering. There is a cause for suffering. I said there is a way out. And the way out is nirvana, which can be attained by following and implementing in our life these eightfold disciplines: right conduct, right meditation, right livelihood, right speech, right action, and so on. Sammik smriti, sammik ajiva, sammik sankalpa. This again, because I want to concentrate on Dhammapada proper, I already elaborated on these four noble truths and also the concept of Ashtanga yoga, I mean the eightfold discipline and liberation on several occasions before. So the idea that there is suffering in the world. Now, what did Buddha mean by suffering? It should be understood. The word used in Sanskrit is dukkha, which if you read the Apte or Monier Williams dictionaries, means suffering. Now, the word suffering, which Buddha explained, which he implied by the word dukkha, is not the suffering that we normally mean in our everyday life. For example, when you don't have money, you suffer. When you are sick, you suffer. When somebody nearest and dearest to you passes away, you suffer. It is not that kind of suffering that Buddha is talking about. What he is talking about is a sense of incompleteness, a sense of imperfection that we all feel when we think of the momentariness, the transitoriness, the impermanence of all the experiences that we undergo in this world. So, these are all changing. Each link leads to another link. So, this cycle of birth, life, death, and rebirth, it continues. And it is not one long, unbroken succession of happiness. Even the so-called happiness in empirical life as one profound aspect of imperfection or incompleteness, that is, even that happiness is impermanent. So it is not really happiness with a capital letter H. So that means there is an incompleteness. This is what actually made Buddha leave his palace and his home, his comforts and his luxurious life. He was born as a prince, the son of a king in Nepal. And he led a normal life. He excelled in all the kingly accomplishments: education, the duties of warrior, all those things he said in Buddha's life you find. Very interesting, in fact. He was a well-accomplished person. But he felt something wrong even in this very happy state of affairs. And Buddhist tradition, the ability to feel a kind of discomfort, an inner discontent, dissatisfaction, even in the midst of luxuries, qualifies you for a search for the higher freedom. If you are happy with all that you have, then you are not fit for this quest for freedom. So Buddha, when he was 28 years old, he was taken out, being taken out on a chariot, and he saw a dead body being taken to the cremation ground in a procession, and a sick man and an old man. And then he saw the face of a monk who was very serene looking, fully in a state of contentment. So the contrast struck him, and he left his palace that day. He was a married man, 28 years old. He had a little child, Rahula. And eventually they all became Buddhist monks, of course, and nuns in course of time. They also joined the Buddhist order, and they are considered to be ideal Buddhists in the Theravada tradition. Anyway, so he left his palace, walked nearly 1200 miles, reached a place called Buddhagaya in today's Bihar state of India, sat under a tree, and according to Lilitha Vistara, it's called, or Buddha Charita, in fact, you find it, it's found in Buddha Charita, Ihasane Sushyutu Me Shariram, Tugasti Mamsam Cha Vilayam Cha Yathu, Aprapya Siddhim Bhujanma Durlabham, Naiva Asanat Kayam Atashalishyati. Buddha told himself, and he made a proclamation silently, I'm sitting here under this tree, let my body perish, let it be reduced to bones and ashes, let it be reduced to bones, let it perish, I won't get up from this seat before and without attaining the highest liberation, which comes only as a result of spiritual evolution through several life cycles. That's a bahu janma durlabham, which means, which is very rare, even after going through innumerable life cycles. So the love means very rare. And then in the process, Buddha went through 543 life cycles mentally. When he was meditating, his mind went back to his previous life cycles. In each of this previous life, he was an enlightened person. He was maybe a bird, an animal, a king or a minister. You find Buddha taking life in so many, taking births in so many levels of existence, animal kingdom and so on. But in each of this life, he displayed something very unique, which is common to the great enlightened Buddha. And eventually, he became Buddha was in this particular life. Now, this is Buddha's story. So, what he meant by dukkha or suffering was the natural feeling of incompleteness or imperfection that every noble person will feel even when he or she is endured with all empirical worldly pressures and enjoyments. That's why suffering, the cause of suffering, then the possible end of suffering, and the path to that possible end, which is called Ashtanga, the right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, right view, and right resolve. So, moral virtues are right speech and right action and right livelihood. The meditation, through contemplation, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, which are meditative disciplines. And then insight, wisdom, maturity of outlook, right view and right resolve. So all these eightfold paths together constitute a moral and contemplative and of course practical disciplines to attain spiritual freedom. Now this is possible only when we feel, well, there is something higher that I must look for. There is something much more profound that could be accomplished in this world. So that's the real implication of the word dukkha according to Buddha. Now there are just a few verses which I may discuss today. The first section of Dhammapada is called Yamaka. Now, Yamaka actually means a verse which has got two parts, a pair of verses. So the first verse in Dhammapada itself is something very interesting. The central teaching of the first instruction is mind is what really matters. It is mind that decides everything. So he expounded this most probably in response to a question from one of his disciples, and to by way of elaborating and explaining the significance, Buddha tells a story. Both together constitute a very unique spiritual literature. And one of the reasons why Buddhism is so pleasantly popular in modern Western world, especially in Europe and America, is it is very simple, straightforward. And it doesn't ask you to surrender your freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom to ask questions. And Buddha applies the principles of psychology. Many of these psychological ideas that Buddha applied can be found originally in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. So we have given around 144 classes on Patanjali Yoga Sutras, frequently quoting from Buddhist literature. You find, you'll be surprised, many of the most profound interpreters of Yoga Sutra were Buddhists. Anyways, I'm coming. Vijnana Bhikshu was a Buddhist anyway, so I will come into that later. So the first of the verse of the Yamaga is, Yamaga means a pair of verses. The whole Dhammapada doesn't come in pairs of verses. Well, first section is in pairs of verses, each following the other. So the first one is Mano Punjangama Dhamma Mano Seta Manomaya. So Manomaya is Sanskrit, Mano is Sanskrit, Dharma become Dhamma in Pali, Manasa Che Padutena Bhasadiva Karotiva. So Karoti is Sanskrit, Bhasadi in Sanskrit become Bhasadi in Pali, you find very similar. Tato is Sanskrit again. Nam dukkham anvedi. Dukkham anvedi is also Sanskrit. Chakkam in chakram. Va vahato padam. This is the first verse in Dhammapada. The central principle is, all our activities, all entities, everything in life and world is preceded by a mental equivalent. We think first and then only we speak, we do. So behind the existence of everything in this world, there is mind. So mind precedes everything, mind decides everything, all that we are, all that we have are the result of our thoughts, of mind. The example is given, Manapunjangama means perceived. The example is something very interesting. An example is taken from an ancient era where bullock carts were common. So the chakram in the wheel has to follow the footprints of the bull or the ox that is driving the wheel. So the footprints of the ox can be seen and it will be followed by the print of the wheel. Like that, behind every action, every word and every thought, there is the mind. So if we can take care of the mind, then many of the problems can be solved. Think of our own times. Every day, every second, every minute, we are bombarded mentally by measureless and infinite number of disconnected bits of mutually conflicting, contradictory pieces of information or ideas. If there is a coherence, if there is a kind of harmony or integrity or interrelatedness behind our thoughts or ideas coming to our mind or bombarding our mind, there will be no problem. But if one idea runs contrary to the other, the preceding one, the succeeding one, the mind goes crazy. So if we can take care of the mind, if mind can be made steady and stable, so that it can even organize and harmonize mutually contradictory thoughts and ideas coming to them, coming to this mind, then lot of problems can be solved. So, if there is pure thought in our mind, then there will be happy experience at a physical level, there will be no suffering. If there is impurity in our mind, then there will be suffering. So this instruction was given actually in relation to a great venerable monk. So the story goes like this, you know. There was an ancient monk in those days. He became a monk a little advanced. He was maybe after several years of leading an household life, then he became a Buddhist monk. And he wanted, because he was aged, somewhat advanced in years, when he turned to monasticism, he wanted to practice, he wanted to go through ascetic practices. He was overdoing it a bit. So he never lay down, he took rest standing or sitting or closing his eyes, sitting and closing his eyes, never lay down. He never slept lying down. So because of his asceticism and exposure to heavy rains and climatical changes, his eyes began to suffer. He started losing his vision, but he did not give up. So, you know, many of the Buddhist monks were great Ayurvedic physicians. In fact, Varaha, one of them was Ashtanga Hridaya, Vagbhada, was written by Vagbhadacharya. Vagbhada was a Buddhist monk who wrote what is considered to be the most fundamental text on Ayurveda. It is called Ashtanga Hridaya. I mean, the essence, the heart of 8 limbs constituting human body mechanism. And his author was Vagbhada. So Vagbhada was a Buddhist. So when this old monk started losing his vision, some Ayurvedic physicians, doctors approached him with some herbal medicine and asked him to apply this medicine to his eyes. But you can apply this medicine only when you lay down. He was not practicing rest or sleep. He was walking and sitting all the time. For 3 months, he had decided to do this ascetic practice. So, slowly, his eyes began to suffer. And in spite of a request from fellow monks and from the Ayurvedic teacher, he refused to apply the medicine to his eyes. Finally, he lost his vision. But the moment he lost his vision, his inner eyes opened. So that is the real significance of this message. He lost his physical eye because he neglected treating his eyes, which he considered to be part of the human body, which he has to transcend. He was a great ascetic. He didn't want to treat his body. So he lost his physical vision. The moment he lost his physical vision, his inner eyes opened. So, and when his inner eyes opened, he became an arhat. Arhat means somebody who has attained nirvana according to Theravada Buddhism, highly advanced aspirant according to Mahayana Buddhism. So anyway, the text is more closely related to Theravada school. So he became an arhat. But he continued walking. So one day, it so happened that the forest road through which he walked was full of termites, these insects that emerge during rainy season, especially in tropical countries. Millions of tiny insects, termites. But he didn't know, he didn't see. So he walked over these termites. And that evening, some of the other monks from the same monastery found that thousands of these insects were killed by somebody who had walked over them. And they knew that it was this great monk who was blind. Because he had become blind because of his ascetic practices. And because of those ascetic practices, he became spiritually awakened. So they went to Buddha, who were residing in the same place. A place called Shravasti, one of the well-known places associated with Buddha's life in northern states of India. So they went and complained to Buddha. So this blind monk had killed thousands of insects. It is against ahimsa. He had physically killed them. Then Buddha told them, what it said, mano punjangama dhamma, mano seta mano maya. It is mind that is significant. Manasa che padutena bhasati va karoti va. Bhasati, bhasati, karoti. Speaking, acting, everything is with mind. Mind is significant. So when the mind is impure, then your actions become impure or violate the principles of dharma. This monk was an elevated soul. He did not know he was walking over these termites, insects, which were killed. So far as he was concerned, he was not killing anybody. So his mind was pure. Therefore, it is not physical actions that are to be taken to be the criteria. It is the mind behind the action that decides whether the action is good or bad. So this is a very interesting. It comes towards the end of the Dhammapada. Of course, remember this particular verse which I quoted comes at the beginning. Remember, so I want to remind you again. This verse that I quoted, mano punjangama dhamma, it comes at the beginning of Dhammapada. And the second one is a continuation of the same idea, emphasizing another aspect of the same idea. The total, the whole text has got 423 verses. The last section, that Brahmana Varga, the last verses which I am going to discuss after this. Now let us just see the next adjoining verse, that means that accompanying verse, because the Yamaka, one of the pairs of the verses. This is verse number 2 in Yamaka Varga. And there the teaching is emphasized from a different perspective. Pure mind leads to happiness. If your mind is pure, if your thought is pure, or if you can make your mind pure, no matter what you do, that purity of mind leads to cessation of dukkha. Rather, it leads to happiness. So the verse is, mano punjangama dharma mano seta mano maya. Very similar to the previous one. Manasa che pasannena bhasadiva karotiva. This is different. Tato nam dukkha sukhamanvedi chaya va anupayini. So remember, dukkhamanvedi is the last line of the first verse of the first chamaka. The second chamaka says, tato nam sukhamanvedi. So how do we attain happiness? How do we attain eventually nirvana, arhathood? The first verse emphasized the idea that it is not physical actions that really count. It is the mind that really counts. So if you happen to do things physically without mind attached to that, then it will not affect us. But on the other hand, if mind is kept filled with pure thoughts, that directly leads to happiness. So that's tatu nam sukham anvedi. Then you know, then happiness invariably follows. Chaya va anupayini. So this another, this again Buddha explained this with the help of a story. The stories are very, very important. The story provides the context. Without the story, the true significance, spiritual significance of many of these verses could not be fully explained. But in many traditions, they sometimes don't pay much attention to the stories. The Dhammapada is a small, tiny work. If you put only the Pali verses together, it's a very tiny book. If you include the commentaries, I mean, if you refer to the stories that Buddha narrated to drive home the idea, then becomes a complete text. So this again is explained with the help of a story. So the verse tells you all dharmas, all entities have perceived the mind, governed the mind, and created by the mind. If one acts and speaks with a pure mind, then sukham anvedi. Then what happens? Happiness is a natural result. This idea behind. Now there is another story. The story of a man who was very miserly, very stingy. His son became very sick. So this man did not try to get any treatment for his son because it will cost money. But he wanted to somehow manage to get some help. So what he will do? He will go about asking Ayurvedic doctors. He will give a brief explanation of his son's illness. And suppose this happened, what kind of medicine normally do you give? But suppose you want to save money of treating, going to Kaiser or somewhere, because it costs money. Suppose you ask a doctor, a friend of yours, one of the members of the congregation, say, well, suppose I get this illness, what medicine do you normally prescribe? He got information like this from many doctors. And he applied those medicines. Somehow he managed. He could save money. What happened? His son's disease aggravated. He was on the point of death. So, then what he did, the stingy father, he took the son, brought him outside, out of the home, and laid him on a bench or a table so people will see and they will come out of their own charitable feelings will help him. So it's a cruel father. Now at that time Buddha happened to pass through that road. So Buddha saw a young man suffering on the point of death. He could understand everything. But when the son saw Buddha passing in front of his home, he was completely neglected by his own father, who did not give him proper treatment because of his miserliness, stinginess. So there's a total contrast from his father, the figure of Buddha. He was full of compassion and so humane in his expression on his face. So the son just saw Buddha, didn't speak. But the sight of Buddha filled his mind with tranquility and peace. And he died. And he died, not only he died, the story goes that he reached a celestial abode. He became an angel. Because he had not done anything to deserve it. But he passed away thinking about Buddha, who happened to pass through the road in front of his home, and that filled this boy's mind with holy thoughts, and that holy thoughts made his mind holy and pure, and as a result of this purity of the mind with which he died, he was born in a higher celestial plane as an angel. Now when the father, the miserly father, found the son had already passed away, he started crying and weeping. Then this angel was his own son, came in a different form, but father could not recognize him. So the father asked him, "Who are you?" And then son said, he didn't explain immediately. Eventually he made it clear he was a son. And then the son said, "You know, I have a problem. I have a chariot, but my wheels are broken. Can you get some wheels for my chariot?" The father, who was weeping and crying at the death of his son, whom he had neglected, was now repenting at heart. So he wanted to compensate for his sinful deed of neglecting his own son, and was eager to get this boy whatever he wanted. At that time he had not recognized his son, because son was totally different shape and form, a divine person. "So I want you to give me the sun and moon as the wheels of my chariot." The father could understand it. And then the son brought out his true identity. "See, you are so foolish in neglecting the treatment of your own son when he was living with you." Father recognized his mistake and became a repentant person. He became full of remorse and he repented. So the idea is, the son accidentally happened to meet Buddha, and when he was dying, he could die, he'd live, he could breathe his last with some holy thoughts, and that holy thought gave him an ascent in his spiritual consciousness. This is how Buddha reinforces the idea. Tam tato nam sukhamanvedi chaya va anupayini means, when you do anything, manasa che pasannena bhasati va karoti va bhasati bhasati, Pali becomes bhasati and karoti Sanskrit itself. With a pure mind, with holy thought in your mind, if you speak and if you do things, then the natural consequence will be that you will be happy. So behind happiness, there should be a pure mind. And behind every unhappiness, there is an impure mind. So that is why mind is what really matters, is the emphatic message of these two verses. The second part of the Dhammapada, which I'm going to discuss, it comes at the end of this text. The text is called Brahmana Vagga. It's called Brahmana Vaggo, means the section dealing with Brahmana, means holy person, enlightened person. So Buddha, as I mentioned earlier, ends these verses, Tam Bhuh Bhumi Brahmanam, Tam Brahmanam Bhuhi, Tamaham Brahmanam Bhuhi, like that it changes. But the end is almost identical in most of the verses. Now, what is this Brahmana idea? When you give a discussion like this, especially in modern times, it may be appropriate to give an idea of this ideal of Brahmin in ancient India. So, the ideal of Brahmana was a spiritually enlightened person. In any tradition, there are people who don't believe in God but are spiritually enlightened. One surprising and one astonishing aspect of these ancient ideals is, it doesn't directly emphasize that you should go to a place of worship, read a book, and confess to a priest, or you should proclaim yourself that you belong to this faith system or not. Nothing of the kind. Total freedom from dogma and dogmatism. That is one unique, blissful aspect of this idea. It's a universal spiritual idea. It has nothing at all to do with casteism, because many I have heard this expression somewhat funny. In India they have caste, in Europe they have class, in America there is cash. But casteism was not an integral part of India's spiritual tradition. It was unfortunately a part of India's social structure, but it became like that only in the later centuries. It was an unfortunate privilege system that crept into Indian society, Hindu society, not during the Vedic times, but during the post-Vedic age. So, to give an example, before coming to Buddha, I want to give the background. And surprisingly, for many of you, you know, Buddha's definition of a Brahmana in Brahmana Varga Dhammapada is almost identical, not just similar, but identical with the 18 verses in the Bhagavad Gita, second chapter from 55th to 72nd verse of Bhagavad Gita. The Sthita Prajna Stadochide, whom I call a person of steady wisdom. Lord Krishna says, him I call a person of steady wisdom, spiritual enlightenment, spiritual wisdom. The same idea you find in Brahmana Varga and Buddhamapada. Almost identical. So that's why, you know, in the Gita itself, Yavanartha Udabane Sarvada Sampradodagi Tavan Sarveshu Vedeshu Brahmanasya Vijanataka. So the Brahmana means a person who is spiritually enlightened in that sense. So Yadeva Moksha Sadhanam Tadeva Vadeyam Na Anyat, that Ramanuja says. Snana Panadi Panadihi Arthaka Palam Prayojanam Sa Sarvaka Arthaka Sarvada Sambhudo Dagi Tavan Eva Sambhudidi Tatanda Bhavaditi Arthaka. Shankaracharya says, you know, suppose there is a flood. When there is a flood, the rivers, the ponds, and the wells, all streams will be filled with water. Then you don't need to go to a pond to take a bath. And in ancient times at least, there was no need of going to a well to get drinking water. There's water everywhere. No, so a Brahmana is a person who has reached a transcendental, universal, spiritual realization, in which he recognizes the presence of the same divinity, divine reality, everywhere, omnipresent, immanent, and transcendental. That's why even Madhvacharya says, Brahmana Brahma Anatiti Brahmana Aparoksha Jnani, a person who has experienced this transcendental spiritual experience of unity with the entire creation, with the absolute reality, Brahman. Such a person is Brahmana. This is the Vedantic interpretation of a Brahmana. Now let us come to the 422nd verse that comes to the end of Buddha's Dhammapada, it's called Brahmana Varga. Usabham pavaram viram mahesim vijidavinam anejam nakatakam buddham tam aham brumi brahmanam. This Buddha says, him I call a brahmana or an enlightened person. He is a sage who has realized the supreme truth. He has conquered death because he has realized his immortal spiritual dimension and is devoid of all wrong feelings, all blemishes. He has washed away all his evil. He has awakened buddham, that's a buddham tam aham. He is awakened to the essentials of spiritual life. Such a person I call a brahmana. This is the interesting story here. Now, do you know the interesting context of this instruction? Buddha used this, he gave this instruction in a very extraordinary context, social context. Anyway, the story is like this. He was talking about a person who was a great Buddhist monk called Venerable Angulimala. But this man was not living as a sage all his life. So when people went to Buddha and said something about him, then Buddha said, "Monks, my son Angulimala has no fear, for monks like my son, they are all noble, they have reached the highest enlightenment." And then Buddha gives the story of this Angulimala. So you can imagine an ancient sage whom Buddha recognized as his disciple, as an arhat, that means liberated person who has reached nirvana. And when some other monks ask something about him, Buddha gives the story. The story is very interesting. This Angulimala was a brilliant student in the University of Takshashila. Takshashila is in today's Pakistan, West Punjab. You can see the relics of Takshashila. It was a university all the way from 1200 BC onwards. So during Buddha's time and before Buddha's time, it was a famous university. So Buddha tells the story. This Angulimala was a brilliant student in the University of Takshashila. Those who are interested, if you go to website, you can see the ruins of this ancient university, which was a Hindu university before Buddha's birth. And later, Buddhism also flourished in the university. Many of the early great thinkers who spread Buddhism in Afghanistan, Central Asia, were students and teachers of Takshashila. And many of the early students who came from China to India to study Buddhism from 3rd century BC to about 4th, 5th century AD were students of Takshashila or Nalanda, that is in today's Bihar state. So this Angulimala was a brilliant student in this University of Takshashila. And you know, his name was Ahimsaka. Angulimala, you know, the meaning of the name, a person who adorns himself with a garland made of human fingers. He became a monster, a criminal, and he used to wear a garland made of fingers cut off from his victims. That was the name which he later got. But this man, when he was a student at the university, had a different name. It was Ahimsaka. Because he was so non-violent, he was so steeped in the ideal of non-violence and pacifist ideas, and he was an example of freedom from jealousy, hostility, violent thought, violent deed, and so on. Buddha knew that this man was actually a great Buddhist in his previous life, but he happened to be born as the son of a minister of the particular kingdom, and he joined the university as a student. What happened, you know, because of his brilliance, because he was such an outstanding student, his classmates became jealous of him. He was so accomplished, so perfect in everything, that they all became jealous of him, and they became hostile towards him. They wanted to bring him down. So they planted a very vicious doubt, a very nasty suspicion in the mind of the teacher of the university, the most prominent teacher of the university, his guru. And that was a most heinous crime or sinful deed that they accused him of. In spite of the fact that he was the embodiment of all virtues, because of utter jealousy, they became hostile towards him. They made the teacher suspicious about him. And now the teacher wanted to get rid of him. But he was such an outstanding student, he didn't want to do it openly. So he told his disciple, this Ahimsaka, who later became Angulimala, towards the end of the education, every student should give what the Guru Dakshina. Guru Dakshina means, in those days, education was free. The teachers never got salary. And the kings and rich people provided all that was needed. And students did not pay any fees either. So the only token of gratitude that was expected from a student was that at the end of his education, the student should give something as a token of his gratitude or respect. It may be a few twigs for firewood. It may be a glass of milk. It may be writing a book based on what he has learned from the teacher. It could be anything. Or maybe a token respect, maybe a small, tiny amount, because nothing was expected from students. But this teacher was turned against this Angulimala because of jealousy of his classmates. So the teacher asked him, "You give me one Guru Dakshina as a token of gratitude. I want a garland of human fingers." You can imagine the horrific nature of it. So Angulimala protested, "No, I cannot do that." But then as an ideal student, he has to do that. He left his home. And he started collecting human fingers. He was a well-accomplished man, so he could fight with many people. He killed them and he cut off the fingers and made a garland. He was trying to collect that. Once it so happened that he needed 1,000 fingers, human fingers. It was what the guru had asked for. He had collected 999. Only one was needed. Now, coming to know of this incident, the king also started to hunt him down, to imprison him, to punish him. See, mother came to know of that. Mother came crying and weeping, came very close to Angulimala. Angulimala had become totally blind to fundamental human qualities. And he would have even cut off the fingers of his own mother. At that time, Buddha appeared, standing between his mother and Angulimala. This is the story, Buddha's story. So you can imagine the predicament. Angulimala had become such a monster. Because on the one hand, his sense of revenge against the classmates who became jealous of him, who became so hostile. And that made him a monster. And so he had lost all his human character. He became a human monster. Then Buddha appeared. So he thought Buddha's fingers look wonderful. He was a prince. So maybe he had a fresh supply of 10 fingers. So Angulimala chased Buddha, but he could not catch up with him. Buddha was standing there, slowly moving. Angulimala running after him, but he could not catch up with Buddha. Finally, Buddha stopped. And then Angulimala also stopped. Then Buddha told, "You should also stop. Ehi bhikkhu." So when Angulimala stopped, Buddha told him his own past, about his own past, explained to him, and then he said, Buddha told him, "You stop." Angulimala told him, "Buddha, please stop. I want your fingers." Buddha told him, "You stop." So "you stop" means you stop your samsara. You stop your cyclic rotation going through these innumerable life cycles of being born, living, suffering, and dying and reborn. You should come out of this terrible bondage. So the moment Buddha uttered this word, Angulimala suddenly recollected his own past life, his own previous samskaras, came back to his mind. So this aberration in his life, because of the unpleasant experiences he had to undergo in the Gurukula, in the Takshashila University Gurukula, he completely transcended, overcame all those evil tendencies. He suddenly recollected his own previous life, when he was himself a great meditator, a great devotee, a Buddha. And then Buddha uttered one word, Ekhi Pikko, come monk. And when Buddha uttered this word, this man became a great sage. So he was known as Arahat. So when some people asked Buddha questions about Angulimala's previous life, Buddha told him he had overcome all this. It was an aberration in this life, but now he had transcended all this. He became a great sage. So what does it show? It shows a true holy person is one who overcomes all his aberrations and all other unpleasantness and recognizes his true identity. Angulimala recognized his true identity and he became an arhat. So he was considered to be an arhat in the Theravada tradition. Now this did not happen overnight. Buddha recognized Angulimala's past life, just as he recognized his own past life. You have to remember, if you have read the Jataka tales, you find when Buddha meditated under the Bodhi tree in Bodhgaya, during those days, during the course of his meditation, his previous life experiences came back to him as flashes of pictures. So it was a gradual ascent to Buddhahood. Like that, Buddha knew this man's previous life. Buddha's presence enabled Angulimala to rediscover his own spiritual past. And when he rediscovered, he recognized his own spiritual identity. He became an arhat. Arhat in Buddhist tradition means a person who has attained nirvana in the Theravada tradition. Now you find many such interesting aspects in the Dhammapada. So there is another one. The last verse of Dhammapada says, Yo Pube Nivasam Vedi Sagapayam Chapasati Ado Jadikhayam Patu Abhinja Vosido Muni Sabba Vosida Vosanam Tamakam Bruhi Brahmanam. So Buddha says, who is a Brahmana? Who is a holy person? Who is an arhat? Who is somebody who has understood Buddhism? Such a person will have the capacity to see heaven and hell. That's why, you know, you find Sagapayam Chapasati. Pasyati in Sanskrit becomes Pasadi in Pali. So, and he recognizes his own previous life cycles and he goes beyond, he transcends all those previous samskaras and impressions, he attains the highest nirvana. So, it's a very unique text, very small in size and very profound for any spiritual seeker, not only for those who follow Buddhism, for any spiritual seeker. You need not even believe in God or in any religion to understand the deeper teachings and implications of Dhammapada. So, I just tried to give a bird view, taking just a few Pali verses from Dhammapada. Maybe on some later occasion we will give a much more elaborate exposition. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Namastu.